from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, what's the difference? That's going to be our text for this Christmas edition of the show. Words uttered by President George W. Bush when he was being interviewed by Diane Sawyer this week on Primetime Live. What happened to Sam? Primetime Live! He used to enjoy saying that so much. Anyway, Diane Sawyer had the Prez on, and she didn't grill him. She put him in the George Foreman thing for about a minute and a half about weapons of mass destruction, about which more. And his answer was, well, what's the difference? He could have had him. He was trying to get him, and if he'd had him, he'd have been a danger. But the quote that began that thought was, what's the difference? President of the United States, ladies and gentlemen. Now, Howard Dean has justly been raked over the coals for some loose talk, for some verbiage that probably was ill-considered. Even he admits that. But the President of the United States said, what's the difference whether he had weapons of mass destruction or not? And nobody said a word. I don't even think Diane had makeup to worry about, but, you know, everybody else. Nobody said, hey, this guy's shooting off his mouth, and he's the president. What's the difference? Well, all right, let's ask that question. According to the New York Times, negotiations between the United States, Britain, and Libya over Libya's surprising decision this week to renounce its, hey, we found weapons of mass destruction. They were Libyan. They weren't Iraqi. Isn't that wild? Anyway, according to the New York Times, negotiations between the United States, Britain, and Libya on this back down by Libya began in March, vindicating the CIA in terms of what they've discovered since they were allowed to poke around. According to the Washington Post, intelligence officials have been surprised by the progress of Libya's nuclear program. So we are vindicated or we're surprised. What's the difference? We began the negotiations in March, or, according to the Observer newspaper from London today, the negotiations began 2 years ago, based on Libya providing detailed intelligence on hundreds of Al-Qaeda terrorists as part of its deal to end the crippling sanctions. Past 2 years, or since March, what's the difference? Also, since we haven't found weapons of mass destruction, the United States has declared that our key purpose is a crusade for democracy in the Middle East. The key Libyan negotiator, according to the Observer newspaper, in the deal to renounce weapons of mass destruction, was once an avowed enemy of Britain, accused of exporting international terror and masterminding Libya's support for the Irish Republican Army. He was declared persona non grata by the Brits. London-based Libyan dissidents now fear for their future and express their horror that this guy, Moussa Koussa, ladies and gentlemen, was allowed to enter the country. And, of course, last time we looked, Muammar Gaddafi was still a dictator and a kind of a tyrant. So are we interested in democracy in the Middle East, or are we not? What's the difference? This week, U.S. Senator Bill Nelson of Florida said the Bush administration last year told him and other senators that Iraq not only had weapons of mass destruction, but they had the means to deliver them to East Coast cities, East Coast of this country. Nelson, Democrat of Tallahassee, said about 75 senators got that news during a classified briefing before last October's congressional vote. He said he couldn't reveal who in the administration gave the briefing. The White House directed questions about the matter to the Department of Defense. Defense officials had no comment. But maybe the briefer really meant to say that if Iraq had the means to deliver them to the East Coast cities, that would be a bad thing. You know, what's the difference, really? What is the difference? What kind of trial is Saddam Hussein going to have? That's been the jabber all week. The jabber wiki. And it's a good question, you know. I like Judge Joe Brown. He's tough, But Judge Judy seems a no-nonsense kind of gal herself. And I think she could keep things moving. What kind of evidence will come forward in the trial? After Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons against Iran's army during the 1980s, the Reagan administration tried to prevent criticism of the chemical attack on the Kurds in Congress. And right after the attack on the Kurds, George H.W. Bush, then President George H.W. Bush, authorized new loans to Saddam in order to achieve the, quote, goal of increasing U.S. exports and put us in a better position to deal with Iraq regarding its human rights record. In February 1989, 11 months after Saddam chemically attacked the people of Halabja, John Kelly, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, flew to Baghdad and told Saddam Hussein that, quote, you are a source for moderation in the region, and the United States wants to broaden her relationship with Iraq. According to the Senate Banking Committee, the United States provided the government of Iraq with dual-use licensed materials which assisted in the development of Iraqi chemical, biological, and missile system programs. This assistance included chemical warfare agent precursors, chemical warfare agent production facility plans, and technical drawings, chemical warfare filling equipment, biological warfare-related materials, missile fabrication equipment, and missile system guidance equipment. This continued to go to Iraq until 20 months after he had gassed the Kurds. Will that come out in the trial? I don't know if Judge Judy will allow that in. Finally, what's the difference? How did we get Saddam Hussein? He was betrayed by a top aide who helped the former Iraqi president during 8 months as a fugitive, according to the U.S. military. He was someone I would call his right arm, says Major Stan Murphy, the head of intelligence for the 4th Infantry Division. On the other hand, according to an Israeli intelligence website, the length and hair, state of his hair indicated he'd not seen a barber for several weeks. The wild state of his beard indicated he had not shaved for the same period. The hole dug in the floor was a far cry from his opulent palaces. He looked beaten and hungry. None of his weapons, that the two AK-47s or the pistol was used. The hole had only one opening. It was only camouflaged with mud and bricks, but it was blocked. He could not have climbed out without someone on the outside removing the covering. No communication equipment of any kind was found with him. These seven anomalies, according to this Israeli intelligence website, point to one conclusion. Saddam Hussein was not in hiding. He was a prisoner. His captors bargaining for the $25 million bounty the Americans had promised but are not paying. What's the difference? Hiding or prisoner. What's the difference, ladies and gentlemen? Here's really the case against the guy. And it answers the question, what does Saddam Hussein have in common with Newt Gingrich? Another bad novelist. He spent weeks before the war writing a novel about underground resistance, according to the UK newspaper The Telegraph, writing a novel predicting he would lead an underground resistance movement to victory over the Americans. He spent the time doing that rather than planning the defense of his regime. 40,000 copies of Begone Demons were rolling off the presses as the war began. Most were destroyed by bombing and looting, but the UK newspaper The Telegraph has obtained one of the few remaining copies of the novel. It meanders through the history of Iraq from biblical times to the present and is filled with paranoid invectives against the Jews, who delight in inciting troubles between Muslim nations and encouraging the Romans, a synonym for the Americans, to attack Iraq. The arch-villain of the piece is Ezekiel, an immortal Jew whose presence runs throughout time. He's a fat, evil old man. According to the author, the Iran-Iraq War began when Ezekiel convinced the head of the Iraqi tribe to invade his neighbors. Enter Saddam as the resistance fighter Salim, a pure, virtuous Arab. Salim is tall and handsome with a straight nose. The 1991 Gulf War is portrayed as an ambush by Ezekiel, which Salim shrugs off, driving him out of the country with the words, "Be gone, demon." But why take it from me, ladies and gentlemen, when we can go fully dramatic?
Hussein Radio Theater presents the world premiere radio adaptation of excerpts from Be Gone, Demon, by Saddam Hussein, read by the distinguished British actor Michael Rourke.
Saddam's description of himself as Salim plotting to drive out Ezekiel, the Jewish leader, from his country. Salim's bride asked him if he was prepared to drive out the demon Ezekiel. Salim said, "The intention and power are available. I have made my evaluation of the demon. I am sure of victory against those dogs." Salim's defeat of Ezekiel and his Roman allies. His army is lying in wait to meet the Romans. The king of the Romans gave his orders to begin the charge. The first line of Salim's army shot at the Roman riders with arrows. When the Roman riders fell down, the women of the tribe beat them with sticks or killed them with swords. Salim freed his long hair. He was so strong. He was fighting the Romans like a hawk. He was riding a white horse and shouting, "Allah Akbar, long live the Arabs, and long live Islam." Salim was carrying a sword, and his colleagues were giving him another sword when the first was broken. The Romans ran away as Salim got close to them. Following the Romans' rout from Iraq, Ezekiel and the Roman king returned to their own country to find the twin towers of the Roman capital on fire. Then Ezekiel and the king of the Romans saw the twin towers of the Roman city on fire. Ezekiel was beating his face and saying, "Everything I've collected is gone." One of the Romans was laughing at Ezekiel and advised him, "Try building another two towers and sell the one and rent the other to the Roman king. Both you and the Roman king will rot in hell." Arabs had set the towers on fire. How adventurous they are when they become nervous. The Roman watched the blaze and wondered who had done it. The king said, "Our enemies are great in numbers." Ezekiel answered, "No, such a Fedayeen attack could only be carried out by the Arabs." Ezekiel and the Roman leader ran away after, because they had lost their power and their money. The novel finishes with two verses of the Quran, in which hundreds of little birds defeat a powerful king, recited by Salim as he weeps with joy.
Tune in the next time a crazed ex-dictator puts pen to paper in the service of crappy fiction for the next thrilling installment of Hussein Radio Theater. Portions recorded.
As they must be. Good fiction, bad fiction, what's the difference? Ladies and gentlemen, hello. Welcome to the Christmas edition of Hello, Welcome to the Show.
once a child and now a mother. Christmas came with all its glee. Tinsel topped and crystal covered, she knelt to dress the dancing tree. Gone were all her thoughts revealing, gone was all the drudgery, all the worries she'd been weaving as she knelt to dress the dancing tree. And she thought of the time when she was just a child, and she helped her mother dress the tree. And she thought with a smile, well, her words seemed so wise. She said, you long for days like these. Through her dreams, her sentimenting came the sounds of her sweet son, full of life, so unrepenting. And down the stairs her family came. And she said, little soldier, when you're older, you'll love a girl like me. Kiss her, hold her, remember I told you, dance around the dancing tree. For you long for the times when you were just a child, and you helped your mother dress the tree. And you think with a smile, my words seem so wise. And you long for days like these. Once a child and now a mother, thankful for her family, sleeping babe and sleeping lover, she dances round the dancing tree. She dances round the dancing tree.
Happy holidays from all of us at the Michael Richards Show.
Thank you so much, but there is no such show. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. And in case you're wondering, yes, Saddam Hussein did write it himself. He used to have ghostwriters. But, you know, really, there's no voice like your own. Speaking of which, it's time, even at this holiday season, for the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Yes, some very blessed, two very blessed apologies. Virgin Atlantic Airways has apologized to passengers who have arrived back from the United States more than a day late after their pilot was arrested on a charge of being a drunk. The 383 passengers were stranded in Washington, D.C. after Captain Richard Harwell was arrested shortly before he was due to fly thousands of miles across the Atlantic. Passengers had branded the airline devastatingly pathetic after their replacement flight arrived at Heathrow in London 3 hours late, bringing the total delay to 26 hours. Many passengers also complained of enduring long lines both for a hotel after Friday's flight cancellation and for the check back in at Dulles Airport in Washington. Virgin Atlantic spokesman Paul Moore said the airline held up its hands and apologized for any problems its passengers had faced. He said they had been unable to cope with having double the normal amount of passengers at Dulles Airport, and this led to further delays. And U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft was sanctioned by a federal judge this week. Did you know this? For twice violating a court-imposed gag order in a Detroit trial of suspected terrorists. Ashcroft will not face criminal charges of contempt of court. He apologized for what he said were inadvertent comments. Quote, two serious transgressions committed in this case are simply one too many for the court to abide with, no response, says U.S. District Judge Gerald Rosen, in 83-page opinion. That's twice as many as I got in my lawsuit. Quote, more than a warning is necessary here, unquote. Rosen criticized comments Ashcroft made at two press conferences in which he praised a government witness during the trial of four Arab immigrants in Detroit. The judge chose to issue a public admonishment. I thought that was admonition, but here's the Breyer Service calling it admonishment, a sanction that falls short of rebuking him with a formal reprimand. In a letter that was made public this week, Ashcroft apologized for what he said was an inadvertent violation of the judge's order. Quote, I regret making those statements, which resulted in a disruptive impact on the court's management of the proceedings. I made a mistake in making statements that could have been considered by the court to be a breach of the court's order. Unquote. Says the judge, refusing to refer the matter for disciplinary proceedings to a bar association. Quote, the consistent picture that emerges is one of carelessness as opposed to a willful intent to violate the court's order and prejudice these proceedings, he wrote. Carelessness, ladies and gentlemen. The grown-ups are in charge. The apologies of the week. Of course it's a copyrighted feature. Why wouldn't it be? And even if it weren't, what's the difference?
We're between a rock and a hard place. Not losing face yet, but don't place your bet. We're on our hands and knees, stripped down to our BVDs in the searing heat, eating MREs, tearing apart clunkers, poking around buckers, and climbing up trees. There's nothing to flaunt, there ain't nothing to seize. The body of evidence is gone, we can't get what we want. It's a demonstration of the reason for our invasion, to nail down the persuasion, despite our threats and bribes and pleas. We've found no WMDs. Said without compunction, now we're at the junction of fibbing and lying, so maybe it's time to administer extreme unction to the weapons of mass dysfunction. We're withdrawing Team Alpha and certain Team Beta. Wait a minute, this is later. We've given up on the honchos. Everybody in the deck of weasels could just sit on their haunches. We're setting up the easel to paint a new picture. Playing new hunches. The grunts and the drivers will tell us what we lack. Help walk the cab back. Return us to that state of ease when we find some WMDs. We need some factual satisfaction. We're losing traction. It's the post-war poster kid. It can remove from what we did any hint of future faction. These weapons of mass distraction. Powell needs some air. Blair needs a towel. The pressure is mounting. Life is a fountain. There's an answer no more. The question is what the war was for before. And is it still at the fore? The porous reports over which Powell would pour. Is there truth galore on the cutting room floor? Are we sore? Do Powell and Blair care when the stuff isn't there? As rare as a Suleiman crease, we found no WMDs. Please pardon the interruption, we've wrapped the production, but these questions linger like a hunchback bell ringer in a den of corruption. These weapons of mass disruption. At those first reports, you couldn't sneeze. WMDs aimed who knows where, in the water, in the air, at us, at our friends. No one knows where it ends, but now no one knows where it begins. Even monsters have wings while shedding their skins. Now we're the ones who kicked out the inspectors. You'd suspect us. They could direct us, resurrect us, at least lend us their BS detectors. Because it's just like Wall Street. It's fear versus greed. We all need to move on. Pop down the volume. Reduce the dBs. Take a week off. Some time in Belize. Or maybe we could actually find some WMDs. The pictures were strong, we had great reception. Just trying to clear up a misperception. Were we facing dangers, or did some rangers just have an inaccurate conception involving weapons of mass deception?
WMDs.
Searching from here to Asia for those weapons of mass displeasure. Trying to drive to extinction those weapons of mass distinction.
WMDs.
This is the show. This is also part of the Year in Rebuke and the Christmas show, all smushed into one. Because if you're going to preempt, why not preempt everything? Speaking of which, ladies and gentlemen, if your fine Le Show affiliate preempts this broadcast, and you think it's me that decided not to come in and do a show, why don't you go check www.publicradiofan.com and find other stations around the country which might not have preempted Le Show that day, that you can check in with. Just a friendly reminder from your friends here at Friendtown. Speaking of WMDs, hey, the guy who was heading the effort to find them is going home. David Kaye, the head of the U.S. effort to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, is, well, we found them in Libya, so what's the... has told administration officials he plans to leave before the survey group's work is completed. He could depart before February. The move comes as more of Kaye's staff has been diverted from the weapons hunt to help search for Iraqi insurgents. And at a time when no weapons have been found. Kaye requested the change for personal and family reasons. Yes, he wants to spend less time with his family. That's right. His preliminary report in October said the group had so far discovered only that Iraq was working to acquire weapons and had missile programs under various stages of development. Two officials confirmed Kaye is leaving early and said the question remaining is how soon. He's in holiday leave in Washington and could not be reached for comment. The survey group isn't slated to submit its final report until next fall. There will be a meeting next week at CIA headquarters where, quote, according to a spokesperson, the next steps will be discussed, unquote. Would you like the job? Would you like to head the Iraq survey group? Seems like there's, you know, all you have to do is kind of be grim and resolute. You don't have to really turn up anything. U.S. government officials said Kaye's departure will have little practical impact on the day-to-day work of the group. Yeah. His departure may foster an impression, incorrect in U.S. government officials' view, that the search is effectively over. It leaves the administration looking for a replacement. Yep. I'd say apply now. But, you know, whether it has a head or not, what's the difference? It could. David Kaye could stay on. He could not leave. That's true. That could be true. Other news from beyond the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, on this pre-Christmas weekend. On its corporate website, under a page titled A Fresh Start for Iraqi School Children, Bechtel Group showcases sparkling new classrooms filled with happy young Iraqi students. According to Army investigators, however, quote, in almost every case, the paint jobs were done in a hurry, causing more damage to the appearance of the school than in terms of providing a finish that will protect the structure. In one case, the paint job actually damaged critical lab equipment, making it unusable. Bechtel stresses that the schools in question in the Army's report are a small percentage of the schools it has fixed. Company spokesman said he had no knowledge of an Army investigation. The Army Corps of Engineers inspected all the schools, said the spokesperson, Francis Canavan, but that took place when school was not in session. Faulty repairs did not become evident until the schools were in use. That's the time to find out, ladies and gentlemen. And finally, before we just revert into... you know what? Another good quote of the week. Taped Monday, a rare interview with Vice President Dick Cheney, said, "We've seen just recently, of course, the wrap-up of Saddam Hussein, one of the worst offenders in the 20th century." According to the Yale Genocide Project, the Cambodian, we know about Stalin and Hitler, right? Hitler, many millions. Stalin, upwards of 20 million. Mao, he did a good thing. And the Cambodian genocide of 1975-79, in which approximately 1.7 million people lost their lives, 21% of the country's population, one of the worst human tragedies of the last century. The Yale Genocide Project also includes Nazi Germany, East Timor. We ignored that for 25 years, ladies and gentlemen. Guatemala, Yugoslavia, and Rwanda. Doesn't mention Iraq, the Yale Genocide Project. Didn't George Bush go to Yale? What's the difference? Now, for your listening pleasure, I will read the trades for you. Something's going to work right today, ladies and gentlemen. Just a matter of time. I'm right here, don't worry about it. I'm reading the trades for you. Study finds Prime Time's glass is now one-third full of clutter, from Media Daily News. While even primetime television's biggest boosters acknowledge that advertising clutter has gotten out of control, a new report suggests it may be reaching new heights. The study released by Los Angeles-based consultancy Phase One Communications. Why call Phase Two when you can call Phase One? Revealed TV viewers are subject to a whopping 52 minutes of promotional clutter during a typical three-hour block of primetime programming. That figure is up 8% from 2000 and 36% from 1991. The average length of commercial breaks has also grown to 3.05 minutes, a 41% jump from 1998. The Phase One report concluded that if a viewer were to watch three consecutive hours on any of the networks during prime time, he or she would be exposed to a minimum of 130 commercials, promos, or public service announcements. Fox boasted the smallest number of commercials, ABC the most. I'm feeling sorry for Fox now. One question left unanswered by the study is how ad messages inserted into primetime shows, whether via product placement or other means, are affecting the clutter ratios. But the consultant doubts whether product placements annoy viewers as much as other promotional content. He explains, "We had an absurdly non-branded world on television for years. It was ridiculous for people on scripted shows to hold up a box of cornflakes with no name on it." What the consultancy finds more intrusive, God bless him, and thus more likely to engender viewer resentment, are promotional messages transposed on the screen during programs. I mentioned this to the head of one of the cable networks, who said, "We don't do that." That's right, they don't watch their own. And Blockbuster Incorporated President and Chief Operating Officer Nigel Travis called for an end to regional coding on DVDs, saying they merely create more opportunities for piracy. You mean it's not the downloaders who are creating piracy, it's the studios? Life can sure seem nutty when I read the trades for you, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature. 2003, of course, the year of the war in Iraq, but so many other developments to recap in a year in rebuke. One of my favorites, the release of diaries by former President Truman, in which he gave vent to some thoughts that expressed his distrust for the Jews in the aftermath of World War II. This was President Truman, former President Truman, expressing those opinions. And we wondered at the midpoint of this year what the reaction might be to this revelation. by another former president. Fortunately, a tape, secretly recorded, arrived here at the Le Chaux Dome to answer that question, a tape in the series of secretly recorded tapes of Nixon in heaven.
All right, what else?
You saw the sapphire column?
Yeah. I saw the what?
Bill Sapphire's column?
Sure.
In the Times.
Yep. Still in the Times.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
You know, but how the hell am I supposed to read the Times, you know, up here? I mean, you know.
Yeah. Well, I get it faxed to my cloud.
Yeah. Well, then, mister, I get it faxed to my cloud. Maybe you can explain why.
Well, you still have the Do Not Disturb Until 3000 sign on yours.
Yeah, well, I know, but I mean, a newspaper, for God's sake. Oh. I mean, for Pete's sake. Jesus. I mean, jeepers, this political correctness thing up here is driving me nuts.
Well, I did tell you, I got word from some people here that just get the swearing tone down, you know. And yes, delivering a fax qualifies as a disturbance. Some people here really don't want to keep up anymore.
Yeah, well, sure, they're sheep wherever you go. Mm-hmm. We all know that.
Yeah.
Cripes. You could never win an election if everybody read the GD paper, you know. So
we'll get the sign taken off the...
So what did Sapphire say?
Oh, no, it was just he'd had an imaginary conversation with you.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And the dateline was purgatory. He said you were still doing time in purgatory for wage and price controls.
Yeah, he did, huh? Mm-hmm. Well, it figures.
Oh, yeah.
Sapphire talked a good game.
Mm-hmm.
And to be fair, he wrote a good game.
Oh, but, yeah.
I always thought he underestimated the old man. You know, he didn't think I had enough juice to...
No, I think he was just... trying to be amusing to the East Coast elites.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, well, you know, sure, there's that. Mm. And of course, how is he to know there is no such place, you know, from his...
Yeah, sure.
And, but, you know, talk about pandering to the East Coast WASP elite.
Mm.
I mean, Sapphire's a Jew.
Mm.
Jews don't have purgatory.
They don't?
No. Trust me on this, Holman. I know a little something about our Jewish friends. They do not. Speaking of which, by the way, let's get Truman over here. Yeah, I think it's time we buried the hatchet.
Hmm. You know, some stuff from his diaries just
see?
Got...
See, now that I get. I mean, you know, there's something screwy with the... I guess you wouldn't call it the infrastructure here.
No, that's true.
Anyway, see if Truman's available.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have tried before. From what I get back, I still think he's got a Nixon problem.
From what you get back from him?
From his people.
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
They think if it came out that he'd gone soft on old man Nixon, you know, might kick a little sand in the gears of Truman's sainthood machine.
Yeah. A, how's it going to come out? But I'm not sure it's actually...
Hold a minute. I mean, you know, these people leak up here.
No,
you know? You do know that.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You know, in all the years I've known you, dead and alive, never thought of you as naive.
Thank you, sir.
All right, but you get the Times facts, Dave. You tell me. Has anybody gone after Truman, you know, for his remarks about our Jewish friends?
No, not really.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the liberal contingent is really more focused at on the war thing at this point in time.
Yeah, well, there you go then. Mm-hmm. That's my point in triplicate.
Yeah.
Liberals are giving Truman a pass, you see?
Yeah.
But Nixon, who started all this environment crap and put in wage and price controls and basically did more for the damn liberals than their beloved Bill Clinton ever thought of doing. No.
Now,
if Nixon hated the Jews, you know, there must be something wrong with him.
Yeah.
That's the old liberal line. And, of course, they have every right to...
Don't think Truman hated them. In the diaries, he said he mistrusted them.
Yeah, that's what you say in your damn diary. That's not what you tell Bess when you're engaging in pillow intimacy type activity.
No,
of course it isn't. But, you know, if Truman wants to be so high and mighty around here, let him, you know. Of course, that's his right, you know.
Yep, yeah, nothing we can do.
I mean, if he wants to while away eternity thinking that conversations with Dean Acheson are as deep and as insightful as he gets, you know, I mean...
Yeah, that's his problem.
That's right.
It's his loss.
Yep.
Also, you're not hearing his voice on the diary, so...
I'm not doing what now?
No, his quotes about Jews, you're not hearing him say them.
No, well, of course not. He burned the tapes.
Really?
Well, you know, figure of speech. I mean, they didn't have tapes then.
No, I was going to...
But old man Truman had a very souped-up recording apparatus in the White House. Don't be under any... Don't think he didn't, you know. Hidden microphones...
Mm-hmm.
Lathes to engrave or whatever onto phonograph recordings. You know.
LPs?
I suppose.
Yeah.
Anyway, all destroyed.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure the East Coast elites would dismiss all that as, you know.
Yeah. So much paranoia.
That's right. That's right.
Sure. Sure. But I mean, they said that about people who said the Johnson tape.
Oh, sure. That's right.
And that we tape.
That's right. But you see, it's not... It's not just the liberals.
Mm.
That's the thing. That's the thing right there.
Well, I'm not sure. I don't think I read anything
well,
about
see,
it.
Well, see, Haldeman, one of the great things about being up here is, I may not get my New York Times via fax,
well,
but cable is free.
Yeah.
See? So, of course, it's Ann Coulter. Mm. She's all over the damn tube. Standing up for Joe McCarthy.
Well, good for her. It's about...
Standing up for Hoover.
Yeah, that's right. I did.
But you see, even she, and of course, you know, she goes to a good East Coast school and she's got the hair and the legs.
Although that not together.
No, but...
Hmm? The hair isn't on the legs.
No, that's right.
Yeah.
No, it's not. But even she, you see, she didn't have the guts to... To stand up for RN.
For the old man, yeah.
Nope.
No.
No revisionist history for me.
Yeah. Comes with the territory.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Man in the arena never gets a break.
Nope.
Even when he's not the only one who distrusts the Jews.
Especially when...
Yep. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Okay, well... Screw Truman.
Mm-hmm.
And screw Sapphire. You know. And as for Miss Coulter.
Mm-hmm. Well, screw her, too.
Nope.
Mm. Nope.
Well, no, you see, because that's what she wants.
Mm. Yeah.
All right. Let's go get some cottage cheese.
Happy Hanukkah! From all of us at the Michael Richards Show.
Now tell me, when was Jesus born?
Last month of the year.
Tell me when.
When was Jesus born? Last month of the year.
Tell me when.
When was Jesus born?
Last
month of the year.
Was it January?
No.
February?
No. March, April, or May?
June.
July. August, September, October, November, the 25th day of December, the last Monday.
Tell me when was Jesus born?
Last Monday.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, Andrew S. Natsios is the administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development. Earlier this year, he said U.S. taxpayers would not have to pay more than $1.7 billion for the reconstruction of Iraq. Yes, you heard me right. The administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, a part of the Bush administration, said earlier this year, U.S. taxpayers would be on the hook for no more than $1.7 billion. So far, of course, a little bit more than that. This was in an interview with Ted Koppel.
You're not suggesting that the rebuilding of Iraq is going to be done for $1.7 billion,
Koppel asked Natsios. Well, in terms of the American taxpayers' contribution, I do, Natsios said. This is it for the U.S. The rest of the rebuilding of Iraq will be done by other countries who've already made pledges. Britain, Germany, Norway, Canada, Japan, and Iraqi oil revenues. But the American part of this will be $1.7 billion. We have no plans for any further on funding for this. This fall, after several months of that transcript being on the website of the U.S. Agency for International Development, it has been removed from the website. What's the difference? It was there, it's not there, it's there, it's not there. 1.7, 107 billion, what's the difference? Going back to a debate that was staged on this broadcast at the beginning of 2003.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is At Loggerheads. Diametrically symmetrical views on an issue of bifurcated contention. Today, which is more dangerous, Iraq or North Korea? On the left, Casey Kasem. On the right, Dick Clark.
First, Casey, Happy New Year from the guy who practically owns it. Second, maybe it will actually be a happy new year if we make it the year that we rid the earth of a little menace by the name of Saddam Hussein. And take it from me, we'll all own that. Why Saddam, of all the bad people in the world, Casey, it's as obvious as a People's Choice winner. Here's a guy who's used poison gas on his own people. Sure, they were Kurds and he's an Arab, but they're still his people. Every bit as much as the kid with the turban who works in my office is my people. He's attacked two of his neighbors, so Casey, if you don't want to send the army there, how about Neighborhood Watch? Seriously, Hussein without nuclear weapons is a bigger threat than Kim Jong-il with them, simply because unlike the leader of North Korea, this guy can't be bought off. Hey, for the kids in the audience, let's boil it down even more. He can't stay bought off. Unfortunately, that's what keeps him looking young. So, Casey, it's okay to keep your feet on the ground, but it's more important to keep your eye on the ball. Nothing sends a stronger message to North Korea than the sight of an American victory in Iraq that's shorter than a hit single. You might not be able to dance to it, but I give it a 99. Casey?
Dick, when Saddam Hussein goes to bed each night, he dreams of being Kim Jong-il. A guy who can scare his neighbors without having to invade them. You know who he is, Dick? He's the guy next door that plays his stereo too loud and makes you think he might be a little bit cuckoo. By comparison, Saddam Hussein is a day under the sweetheart tree. Containing him is like counting down hit records. It's been working for years, so why change it? Besides, Hussein only invaded his neighbors after we encouraged him to. So maybe, before bombing him into the fourth dimension, we should have a little talk with ourselves. North Korea is the real thing, Dick. A desperate country with nukes to sell, and they're willing and able to wheel and deal like a Buick salesman in mid-August. When it comes to confronting North Korea, Japan and China have been missing in action longer than Oasis. And we're spending all our time and attention not on the guy who just kicked out the UN inspectors, but the guy who's welcoming them in. Talk about your monkey business. Dick, don't get me wrong. Saddam Hussein is not a nice guy. I know. I happen to be Lebanese. But if we're going to go around getting rid of every bad leader in the world, we're going to be involved with a whole lot of countries and at least 5 networks. I don't mind keeping my feet on the ground and my eye on the ball, Dick, just as long as my head's not up my ass. From the left, I'm Casey Kasem.
From the right, I'm Dick Clark. And here's one idea we don't go to war with.
It's great to be
at Loggerheads.
And Loggerheads is made possible with the Possibility Grant from the Business Foundation. Business. We're not as crooked as you think. Listen next time when another pair of finely matched opinions meets where the arguments are. At Loggerheads. Right and left designation for entertainment purposes only. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
Ain't no use in getting up early this morning.
Santa put the hurt on you.
Might as well go back to sleep, turn off your alarm and act.
Santa put the hurt on you.
And call me once or twice.
Santa put the hurt on you.
I told him that you wasn't even halfway nice.
So Santa put the hurt on you. Santa put the hurt on you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this Christmas edition and part one of the year in rebuke of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time. If you'd like to preempt it then, I don't know what WHYY you'd want to, but you might do it. And otherwise, we'll be here at same time, same stations on NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, up and down and across North America via Sirius satellite radio, and around the world via the internet at 2 different locations on your computer whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. And it'd be just like knowing the answer to the question, what's the difference, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. The The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. The show playlists always available at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Or not. What's the difference?